check that.
Huh.
I'm hearing some funny noises coming out of my transmitter. I happen to have a standby transmitter here, so if it suddenly fails... I hit it with my fist and it stopped doing it. If it suddenly fails, I'll go over to the other one. I'll be off the air for about 30 seconds while I do that switch over. So, your first requirement is the fact you get less power output on 6 meters is definitely wrong. It should be greater, not less, or at least equal. Looking at screen grid current will give you a hint if the drive is hard enough, if there's enough grid drive occurring, if the grid is properly resonated and being driven hard enough. And the alignment of your 6-meter circuits that are driving that grid is something to check on. By way of your RF voltmeter, which I think you own, there's various ways that you can confirm by putting in a temporary sniffer circuit and reclosing the box. You'd be able to find out exactly how much RF voltage is really getting to the grid and is the grid being properly resonated. So you'll eventually get to the bottom of that one, Rich. Let's see what Jim's got to ask tonight. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee. You got it, Jim. KQLA.
About high-speed CW with shore meteor trails. I was reading on QST, an old QST in the ARRL database online, and it was an article about how since meteors, not very large, constantly fall in the Earth's atmosphere, you can actually using those short ionized trails, those very short ionized trails, and then slow it down so that it is something that the human can decode and then make contact with high-speed CW using very small meteors on those trails. If you or anyone had any more information on that, it would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, as you start studying meteor scatter propagation a little bit more, Jim, you're going to discover that the length of time that the trail out of the meteor hitting the Earth's atmosphere is ionized heavy enough to operate at your particular frequency. It's 1 over frequency squared or frequency cubed. In other words, as you go from 6 meters to 2 meters, for instance, where the frequency is almost 2.5 times higher, there's probably and no matter how far away the propagation in the world, when you get your June issue of QST magazine, you're going to see a beautiful article on page 88 giving you a lot more 6-meter summer e-skip. That section of the latest downloads for these various protocols, he's got various ways of setting up computers, and some of them are emphasized for from your point of view, not a closer and further from you compared to, therefore the echo signal you get from the left hand signal might be giving you, left hand crater is giving you a positive Doppler, a slow one, the right hand crater on the right hand side, and he's got a lot more performance if you know what TB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
It's a KC2WGZ. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net?
Yeah,
we got a nice question about a Yagi, which is sort of being revisited. But this young gentleman, let me let it drop and I'll proceed. Okay, this young gentleman's investigating how Yagis work, and he would like to know your explanation on why just increasing the material on the active element or the reflector isn't sufficient to improve gain on the Yagi. So maybe you could run a quick operation of a Yagi form. KC2WGB, over you, Vic.
In some respects, he may be asking the question to the right group of people, John. Back in 1978, well, starting in 1972, I was entering these antenna gain competitions that were held by the East Coast VHF Society at what was then called Trenton State Teachers College. I think it's now called the College of Trenton, New Jersey. The New Jersey College, it's got a fancier name, but Alan Katz, K2UIH, Dr. Alan Katz, is the guy who heads the electrical engineering department. Starting in roughly 1969, 1970, he and a bunch of guys would hold a once-a-year get-together on the campus in which they literally set up an antenna range and really measured the gain of all the available antennas on 6 meters, 2 meters, 432, and 1296. And we rapidly discovered that all the manufacturers were fibbing, lying through their teeth. In other words, what gain they claimed and what they really were delivering were very different. And throughout the 10 or so years of those antenna competitions, and I entered 9 or so of those antenna competitions with antennas of my design, throughout those 9 or 10 years, the winning antenna on each band usually was a homebrew antenna by amateurs. Almost never was it a commercial product, even for the same number of elements. So it was obvious that the manufacturers were not doing a good enough job. I won that antenna competition on quite a number of years with Yagi Designs, the so-called RIW-19 Yagi, which eventually became a commercial product, which I didn't manufacture. A good buddy of mine in Bay Shore was manufacturing at W2KRM, George Flanagan, took my design and started manufacturing thousands of these darn things, 19-element Yagi, insulated Yagi for 432. So how a Yagi works, and you can see an article of how...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
NBC.
Okay, Bob recognized the Yagi tuning procedure, which is called a ratiometry antenna range. If you really want to do fine tuning of a Yagi, you'll find that in QST Magazine, February issue, I think it was 1976. 1976, February, but it's an article by K2RIW as to how to set up a antenna range which allows you to see very small fractions of a dB of increase. As you're tuning the individual elements of a Yagi, what makes the gain go up and down and what makes the standing wave ratio go up and down is not common sense. And you need a good antenna range that can resolve that. A ratiometry antenna range is something that I thought I invented. Whether I really did or not is questionable. But I do now know that the Rome Air Development Center is using a ratiometry antenna range. Okay, what did I discover? Let me drop... The main thing I discovered throughout all of that antenna tuning and those competitions where I won some of them, very, very different. Common sense would lead you to believe that if, for instance, I have a three-element Yagi, reflector in the back, driven element in the middle, and a director up front, you would think that as I start making the director very fat, that it would start casting a shadow on the rest of the antenna when it's doing receiving, and therefore the gain would go down. The opposite happens. To a small degree, the gain goes up. One of the ways that that really got proven is when WA5VJB, Kent Britton, on a number of occasions would appear at an antenna gain competition in Texas or at the Central States VHF Society. He would make a Yagi antenna out of the CD-ROM discs. In other words, these discs that are about 5 inches or 6 inches in diameter. He would put three of those discs on a wooden dowel with just the right spacing and ways of tuning them a little bit by cutting the edges with the nibbling tool. He would make a Yagi out of three round, flat, metallic objects. That's the biggest echo, that's the biggest shadowing area you can get. And he got full performance out of it. So your eye optically sees a shadow. The radio wave does not see a shadow. That's the first thing you got to discover. You can also get some hints about proper Yagi tuning if you go to an article I've got on the microwave reflector. If you go to WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org, WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org, that's Tom Williams' website. You go to the bottom of that website, and you'll see Yagi tuning information by K2RIW. You look at those two graphs, and you read that article, you'll get another hint about Yagi. Let me drop. And from my point of view, what is a Yagi? A Yagi is a driven element that acts like a dipole, radiates like a dipole, and gives you a good impedance match and a good balancing function to your particular transmission line. That begins the transmitting process. The reflector out and back is usually longer than the resonant length, so it looks like an inductive object, because it's beyond resonance in length. The directors up front are shorter than a half wavelength in length, shorter than the resonant length, so they look like capacitive devices. And the bottom line of all this is that what the Yagi really And I've got some patents on Yagi's recently issued by the U.S. Patent Office. It is a number of tuned objects with a particular amount of reactants being presented at that particular position in space. That director up front is a kind of capacitor in free space because of the way it's resonated. And whether that director up space is a dipole-like structure, a ring-like structure, a triangular-like structure, whether it be a disk, like these CD-ROM disks or whatever, no matter what that object is, if at the particular polarization at your particular frequency, it is just the right amount off resonance that presents the right amount of capacitive reactance, and it is located in the right position, it will give you the Yagi phenomena. What is the Yagi phenomena? If your eyes operated at the radio frequencies when a Yagi is in front of you, you would think you're looking at a magnifying glass. You know the way you take a magnifying glass in the sun, let me drop, and you take that sunlight and you focus it down to a point on the newspaper and you burn a hole in the newspaper. Optically, you know what a magnifying glass does with sunlight shining on it. If your eyes operated at UHF frequencies and you looked at a Yagi, you would think you're looking at a magnifying glass. Those directors up front are taking that great big chunk of energy beyond the dimensions of the elements. That's a spooky idea. It's doing that. So it's gathering energy from a large diameter of space, focusing it like a magnifying glass onto the driven element. The driven element picks up that signal, sends it down the transmission line, it moves the signal strength meter on your receiver, and the antenna itself ends up with directivity. It ends up with a antenna pattern that's a little bit like a flashlight beam. Now, there's a hell of a lot of other things going on that I haven't told you about, but this is just scratching the surface as to what is a Yagi. It was invented by a man named Hindusugu Yagi, 1928, and way back in 2004, a guy named K2LIW had the nerve of repatenting a Yagi 75 years later by making certain kinds of changes to the Yagi to improve its performance, and a patent was issued, and it's now a commercially product being used on an RFID reader that's being used. Thousands of them are out there these days right now reading RFID tags. My Yagi design, if you know what I mean. Let's see what Bob's got to say. K4, November, Bravo, Charlie, K2LIW. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, thanks there, Dick. We've wandered well into the territory of the next subject, but I was wondering if, back on the previous subject of plate circuits and stuff and strip line, I thought you were going to go the next step and discuss techniques in combining several strip line or several 4CX250Bs for more power, combining dual strip line amplifiers as opposed to running them in parallel or push-pull. If you feel like going back there, you know, I'm all ears. Back to you there, Dick. K2RIW from K4NBC.
Okay, that's Bob from the, let me think now. What am I going to call it? The country of Florida. The borough. The borough of Florida. There we go. The borough of Florida. It could be the, let's see, what does Texas call itself? The independent, I can't think of the word they use for that territory. Okay. As I started off with that one, it was Rich N2EO who asked about strip line. I gave him warning in the beginning that because of a time constraint, because of our promise of what we do during the first hour, that all we're going to do is scratch the surface. The strip line amplifier techniques and methods of combining them and input loading and output loading and whatever, that's going to be questions that Rich is going to come back in the next week and the week after that asking further questions. So we can't cover all of strip line in one night, Bob. A deep subject. I got deep into it starting in 1969 because I was working for Airborne Instruments Laboratory. A guy named Hank Keen, W2CTK, Whiskey 2 Charlie Tango Kilowatt, is one of the inventors of strip line, and he was one of my mentors as I started working for AIL in 1964. Beautiful. There couldn't be a better fit. Here's this guy alongside of me, two desks away, inventing strip line, inventing strip line techniques, working on kilowatt amplifiers and 10,000 watts and megawatt amplifiers using waveguide and strip line. He's a real waveguide expert and a rotary joint expert. And I started asking him a whole lot of questions. He recognized my enthusiasm, so similar to like the enthusiasm we hear from Jim these days. He recognized that enthusiasm, and he started doing data dumps to me. And I was sucking it up like a sponge, and a couple of months later, out came the amplifier, tripler, strip line amplifier, and eventually the parallel kilowatt amplifier. So now you know where it's coming from. So it's a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now, when it comes to techniques for putting two tubes in parallel, which when I first sent that article to Ham Radio Magazine as my second article, the first article was the February 1970 article on an amplifier tripler for 2 meters and 432. That was my first article. It was on the front cover. It was the lead article of the February 1970 issue. A couple of months later, I mailed him this beautiful article on a strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432, and Jim Fisk, the editor of Ham Radio Magazine at the time, turned it down. It was positive. It was a nut paper. At UHF frequencies, you can't put tubes in parallel. They've got to be run push-pull. Everybody said that. Therefore, he considered it a nut paper, and he mailed it back to me and said, reject it. I mailed it to QST Magazine, and they printed it as a special article of a new scientific breakthrough. And for the next 5 years of his life, he sent me a letter every year saying, please forgive me, please send us some more articles. So that was one of his goofs from my point of view. The idea was a little bit too radical. So when it comes to strip line and methods of putting more than one tube in parallel or combining more than one transmitter, hybrid combining techniques, I've got a couple of articles on just that. That's a whole art in science in itself, and we'll have to get into that in future weeks, Bob. And as you come in future weeks asking that question, I can tell you a lot of things about it, but I'll give you one quick piece of information that everybody misunderstands. Let me drop. You start studying...
Meters is open. I'm listening on the WB2HWW repeater down here in the sixth borough. That's the word you were looking for, the sixth borough. Back to you.
Okay, I could call it the sixth borough, called Florida. But when you start studying the book on hybrid combining techniques, putting more than one transmitter together by some kind of a power... leap, the nearest 0.05 dB, and that the phase shift between the two has to be to the nearest 1 degree. You're led to believe that is true. Absolutely dead wrong. You can have 30 degrees of error in phase before any significant change takes place in overall combining efficiency. You can have multiple decibels of amplitude error before you start losing a lot of efficiency. The books are making much too severe a requirement for amplitude and phase combining when it comes to hybrid combining techniques. I've written a few articles on this subject, and so with strip line techniques, among other techniques, you can get very high efficiency combining. But now the original question we're addressing right now is Yagi antennas. And can you be combining multiple Yagi antennas, very similar to combining multiple transmitters? You can see in CQ Magazine, I'm guessing it's around the 2006 or so issue. I have to find out what issue it is. I have to find out what month it is. I should know. There's a beautiful picture of a two megacycles. Each Yagi 15 times 19, I think it's 304. Real nice tropo with that for CAW. So combining techniques, there's a whole art and science to doing that. And the phase accuracies and amplitude accuracies are nowhere near as severe as you're led to believe when you read those articles. That's one of the first things I want to bring to your attention. So we'll be discussing this subject in future TechNets, Bob. Hang in there, just that we can't do everything at night, on one particular night. This particular question will give you more gain per dollar, more gain per pound of material, of anything there. Single Yagi, you can easily get the same amount of gain. It's funny that the very early radars in World War II were Yagi. Had a thump. Burrow. WGB, KQLIW.
Well, does that make sense?
Dowell, I think it was. He presented that at the Central State VHF Society in kind of an antenna last week or a week ago. Yeah, a week ago. The advantage of using round discs for the directors is they are not polarization sensitive. If your driven element of the antenna happens to have a vertically polarized dipole and a horizontally polarized dipole, and if each of the directors and reflectors are made out of disc materials, now the antenna is completely polarization insensitive. Feed the vertical driven element, and it's a vertically polarized antenna. Feed the horizontally polarized driven element, and it's a horizontally polarized antenna. Feed both antenna elements simultaneously, depending on whether or not the signal is in phase or out of phase, leading or lagging in phase, it will generate clockwise circular polarization.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As a Yagi, it gives you full gain while it's generating clockwise circular polarization. Reverse the phases, and it makes counterclockwise circular polarization. Feed the horizontal vertical element in phase, you'll be making slant 45 degree linear polarization. Feed them out of phase, exactly 180 degrees, and you'll be creating slant 45 degree left side, minus 45 degree linear polarization. You have complete polarization agility by depending on what amplitude and phase of the two signals you feed to the two driven elements once all of your directors and reflectors are these round discs. Ain't that an interesting antenna? If you want to play around with polarimetry, and that's what the radio telescopes are doing. When a radio telescope looks at a star, by measuring how much noise the star is making, horizontal, vertical, clockwise, counterclockwise, by measuring the ellipticity, by measuring the polarimetry of the star, it gives them a lot of information as to what was the local magnetic field doing in the vicinity of that star. You go one step beyond that, and use the Zeeman effect, where you look at polarization versus different positions across the star field. Like, say, for instance, the nebula looking at, a star that exploded 1,000 years ago, and it's got this great big smear of stuff in space. And now you measure the polarimetry of each pixel of that star field in space, and you look at the Zeeman effect of polarimetry. You now measure how much is the local magnetic field and the direction of the local magnetic field, even though you're making those measurements 1,000 light years away. If you're smart enough, you can take your LIW. You're on to something, John.
KC2WGV. You know, you brought back some memories. I remember the Simone antenna. I believe that was the design of the antenna that was originally used by HBO when they were doing over-the-air broadcasting, and they had those type of antennas mounted on the house, if I remember correctly. And I believe they were the Simone antenna.
You're absolutely right, John. I got one of those in my basement. That was the so-called wireless cable TV at 2.4 gigahertz, roughly 1975 time frame. HBO was doing over-the-air broadcast at 2,400 megacycles, and the Simone antenna was one of the antennas picking up those signals. There's a bunch of discs on a metal rod. I think it was a quarter 20 rod with a bunch of washers and nuts holding each of those discs. I think that there was probably something in the vicinity of 10 or 15 of those discs along the rod. The driven element was inside of a round pot assembly on the back of the antenna. And depending on how you mounted that antenna, you could pick up horizontal or vertical polarization. I don't think they used circular. That was a linear polarized antenna. But the reason they used the discs is that a bird could sit on there and he wouldn't be bending the element. It was mechanically very rugged is the reason they used discs. I think maybe they were planning on someday going CP with it, but I don't think they did. I think that HBO over-the-air broadcast, and I was one of the guys building, I built one of those homebrew converters to listen to 2.4 gigs. In those days, it was considered a super high frequency, and I was getting over-the-air broadcast from the Empire State Building out here in Huntington and watching HBO. Over to you, John. I wonder if you did one of those kind of receptions, K2RIW.
No, but I had friends that had those, and that's how I remember about 35 years ago. You're right. And the system, it worked well. And they weren't much to look at. They weren't large, but yet they did the job. Well, this next question, I'm going to let it drop. And this is right out of Mel's corner. I hope Mel is listening. He's going to love this one. Let me let it drop and I'll come back with this.
A rat race mixer was hell to get running.
Yeah, I think the actual mixer that mixed the 2400 megacycles down to channel 3, I believe in those days it was a rat race mixer is what I think Bob is telling us. Go ahead, John.
Okay, this young ham has two antennas existing right now, 2 meter and a 70 centimeter. They're on two poles up about 30 feet, and they're 60 feet away from each other. Now, what he's asking is, he has a coaxial cable, all RG8U, runs up to the middle of those poles, 30-foot distance from each one, to a set of relays, and that is suspended on a messenger. So he can click these 24-volt relays and switch antennas back and forth. Now, what he would like some advice on, he wants to run a ladder line up, and when those two relays are not engaged, the ladder line would be attached with another set of relays to the outer braid of the coax so that he can use it for HF frequencies. Each length of the wire from the center is approximately 30 feet. He'd like some information on that, and what do you think the possibilities are? This is an experiment for Dick. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, if I had a good 432 antenna mounted on a pole 30 feet to the north of the house, so to speak, and a 2 meter antenna mounted on a pole 30 feet to the south of the house, I think I would get the best bang for my money by using reasonably low loss hardline. And the lowest loss hardline for the dollar is the 70 ohm hardline used by cable television companies. You go visit a stockyard of a cable television company, they buy this stuff on 5,000-foot reels. When they got 200 feet left on the end of the reel, they're afraid to start another run down the block because they'd have to use a splice, and the splice is considered undesirable. So the reel with 150 or 200 feet on it is brought back to the stockyard. You go to that stockyard, and you talk very nicely to the guy who runs the place, you probably can get the chunks of that cable free of charge, 150 and 200 feet long. And there are various ways that you can build and buy connectors to go on the end of that cable. Well, that cable is very low in loss, made for direct burial, and give you the lowest loss you can get for that diameter. And the diameters come half inch, 7/8 of an inch, inch and a quarter, and so on. Very low loss, foam-filled, hard-line cable, very rugged. You try buying that from the Andrew Company, you'll pay $5 a foot, and you can get hundreds of feet of it free of charge if you just speak nicely to the guy that runs the stockyard, because he's got a whole bunch of these reels laying around and he doesn't know. So using external relays so that you got one piece of cable going out there and then going to the individual antennas and remotely powering those relays, on paper it looks like a good approach, but having the relay in the house, having separate feed lines coming into the house, in my opinion, gives you a lot more bang for the dollar and a lot more simplicity and high probability of proper operation. Now when it comes to the other antenna he wants to string wire antennas from your poles and your trees and whatever, and have some of them parallel to the ground, some of them vertically polarized, some of them crisscrossing, to string multiple wire antennas fed with 600 ohm open wire line, you get a lot of performance out of those. And they won't interfere with the coax cables as long as the coax cable is not a resonant length. So what he's describing as a method of doing elaborate switching by which the lines going to the antennas become used on multiple frequencies, without a doubt it's doable. When you see how difficult it's going to be to get high performance out of it, and when you look at the reliability you're going to get, other than a guy who wants to just prove it can be done and that's his master's degree in electrical engineering from the school, I'm saying it might not be practical. Yeah, there's a zillion ways you can do it. I've done some of these switching techniques. And external switching with relays out in the weather, eventually they give you some problems. To have the relays in the house, have hardline cable going out there with good weatherproof connectors, and wire dipoles fed with open wire line, those are going to give you the highest performance, the lowest of grief, the least amount of reliability problems, and the most amount of adjustability. Once you have individual antennas with individual feed lines, Now you can experiment with making it longer, shorter, tilting it, folding the ends down, zigzagging it, adding top hat capacitors. You got a hell of a lot more adaptability.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You have a hell of a lot more adaptability when you have individual feed lines going to the individual antennas. I'm not saying not to do it. I'm saying I don't recommend it. There are much better techniques. People think they're going to have one real good high-quality piece of transmission line that goes out into their antenna field, and then they're going to have a relay that flips it in various techniques in order to feed the various antennas. Well, once you have individual cables going to the individual antennas, you'll be amazed how many times you can do other things. Like, one of the things I've done is talk to one of my buddies in New Jersey, where he's transmitting on 432, and I'm listening on the 432 antenna. I'm transmitting to him on 2 meters. He's listening on his 2-meter antenna, and we're running full duplex with earphones and talking and listening simultaneously. The next thing I did is to have my buddy in Albany join. So, Dr. Alan Katz, KTUIH, 1969. Let me drop. In those days, I was on 6 meters. So I'm transmitting a 6-meter signal up to K2CBA in Albany. He's listening on 6 meters. He's transmitting high power 432 down to Alan, K2UIH, in New Jersey, in Trenton, New Jersey. Alan in Trenton, New Jersey is transmitting on 2 meters over to me in Smithtown, Long Island, where I'm living at the time. So we have a three-band, three-way, simultaneous crossband. Each guy was picking up the audio of the previous guy, reproducing it into the microphone, and wearing earphones for some of this operation. Therefore, all three guys could hear all three conversations simultaneously. We could talk. We had a three-way telephone conversation, so to speak, like a party line, but a guy in Albany, a guy in Trenton, and a guy on Long Island on the three separate ham bands by using those antennas simultaneously. I had a way of aiming one antenna up north and one antenna to the west, and so with the three-band cross-band technique, boy, we were having a grand old time. And we held that QSO for like a solid hour and a half, 2 hours, because it was so much fun. And so, in other words, we didn't have to wait and listen to one guy to stop talking and then give him answers. We were really talking and receiving. And by the way, both Alan and Judd, K2CBA, are crazy guys that can listen and talk at the same time. So anybody listening to this conversation will say, these guys are off, they're blanking rocker. They're talking and listening at the same time. Who's listening and who's talking? And the answer, we're all doing the above. So having separate antennas with separate feed lines gives you all kinds of extra capability that I think you want to go there. And maybe you want to listen to the second harmonic and listen to the echo on the other antenna. You'd be amazed what you can do with these things. I know I didn't answer the question, but I'm making a bunch of suggestions and telling you why. KC2WGB, K2LIW in SecNet.
KC2WGB. Dick, that conversation must have sounded like three guys in a card game. That must have been hilarious. Well, the thing is, this gentleman already has those two antennas existing right now, and the idea of running the ladder line up and just using the coax that spread 30 feet in each direction from the center is what he wants to use for HF. He only has to run the little relay package up and solder onto the wires. It's going to prevent putting up another set of wires and bringing down another antenna system. So that's what he was asking, and I know it can do it, but I was just wondering what you thought would be more effective. I believe he should put up a separate antenna, but he seems to have the potential. He wants to do it, so I don't know what's going to happen there.
Now, the main feed line going from the shack out to the middle wire line, John, go ahead.
No, Dick, right now what he has is LMR 400 running up to the center point, and there's the relay to switch from the 400 to the 2-meter. That's already existing. So when those relays are opened, there's nothing to prevent him from attaching to the coax, so he feels, and using it that way. But he would have to, he wants to run up a ladder line. He could run up a coax, but he's going to run a ladder line, which he already has.
Yeah, what a... He could, with the ladder line, feed the coax cables I think he had the coax cable going to the 450 antenna from the center post and the coax cable going to the 2-meter antenna. Let's say one's to the north and one's to the south. And he wants to feed the outer shield of the coax cable as a dipole from the open wire line.
Correct.
Doable, but there's a problem. The way the coax relay works is that the coax relay has got a common port and two switchable ports, called port one and port two, but all three of those ports have a grounded coaxial connector to the body of the relay. And now to feed that with an open wire line, to feed the outer jacket of the coax cable, you'd have to open circuit that grounding of the outer conductor. You'd have to unscrew it, so to speak, from the relay. In order to set up kinds of relays where the outer shield is doing the right thing when you're on 2 meters and 400 megs, and then the outer shield is thoroughly floating in space so that it could be a dipole fed by the open wire line, to open up that grounding of the shields at the coaxial relay is a very difficult function. I can think of various ways of doing that, but no matter how you do it, the normal coaxial cable function on 400, in my opinion, is going to be heavily compromised unless you make an extremely elaborate mechanical structure. Wow, that's pushing the state of the art. So removing that ground to feed that shield is the hard part. And you feed nothing but the center conductor. I've done that experiment, by the way. I've made the left-hand side of a dipole and the right-hand side of a dipole as pieces of coax cable, and I fed the center conductor of the dipole as the dipole. Oh boy, is that an experiment. When you do that, you realize that you have a thoroughly shielded right length is a beautiful resonator, IQ resonator, but it does not radiate. You shield the dipole, you stop its radiation. So feeding only the center conductor of a coaxial cable, left side and right side, it is no longer a dipole. If you fed the outer shield as a fat dipole, works like a charm. But removing those grounding connectors at the coaxial relay, that's a very difficult function. You're a good mechanical engineer. Maybe you could think of a way of doing that. But even if you did do it, I'm pretty sure the grounding function on 450 would be heavily compromised. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2IMS.
Station's recognized. Well, Dick, from what I understand, he has double pole, double pro relays. And they're, I don't know if they're RF relays. I believe they are, but they must be a special type. They are glass enclosed. But what's going to happen is when the normal coax is open, there's no contact to the antennas at all. So those coax lines are freestanding. Then he brings in the other two relays from the ladder line to pick up the braid only. So he's got something going on there. I think if he had a good antenna tuner, he might be able to use something like that on two bands. Maybe, you know, 10 meters he should be lucky at, but anything else would be a guess. But it sounds like an interesting project, but I understand what you're saying. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
I think it was N2RMF recognized. We'll get to you in a second, sir. If I was using an open crystal can relay, non-coaxial, which I've done on 6 meters, I could use that for grounding and ungrounding, so to speak, the shield of the coax, as well as switching the center conductors to the right places. I could do that with open frame relays. But if you take an open frame relay and use it on 2 meters, it's going to be kind of yucky. By the time you get to 432 or 450, wow, it's going to really be homely. As far as the way it feeds the coaxial cable, it's going to be a lot of extraneous signal put on the outside shield when you're operating on 450, which is not so desirable. I wouldn't say it can't be done. It's going to be difficult. But it's the grounding and ungrounding of the shield that's the real bugaboo in this thing. And, I guess you could put a resonant circuit in there. No. No one here is easy. I'm not recommending this. I'm not going to say you can't do it. I'm saying it's such a difficult problem, and there's so many ways that this can turn into a minefield and give you a lot of grief. Now, maybe I shouldn't worry about the grief. As you get the grief, it's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to explode. and the Federal Communications Commission is not going to be pounding on your door. But to make it a good, effective antenna on those three frequency regions, because of this grounding and ungrounding of the shield problem, very difficult. I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying that you better study it a whole lot before you make a big investment in this one. And two, it sounded like Radio Mike Foxtrot, RMF. I could be wrong. Correct me on your call letters. Give me your first name and go ahead with your question. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Oh, thank you. This is November 2, India, Mike Foxtrot, and here in LA is Joe. I'm trying to piece everything together in my head. Couldn't you just put a ballon in line on the ladder line so that it could phase properly? Or am I really thinking off on this? Back to you, Dick.
Hey, Joe, I'm awful glad you signed in. You've got the right answer. That is the answer. He's got it. If the coax cable coming from the 450 antenna and the coax cable coming from the 2-meter antenna, both of those antennas have the right number of turns of the coax cable before the coax cable goes into the relay. And because those turns are acting as an RF choke, now he can feed the outer end of those two RF chokes with the ladder line. That's what Joe is indicating here. By way of the RF choke, maybe with a variable capacitor across the RF choke, the multiple turns of the coax, you can make the coax at the HF frequency, at least at one HF frequency at a time, be a open circuit. And now, by splitting the open wire line so it feeds the antenna end of the choke on each end, away from the coax relay, and the coax relay will just be the neutral center. Yes, that is doable. That's the smart way to do it. It's about time we think of these things. Good thing you came along here, Joe. I'm canceling out what this guy writing a letter or an email to John has as a fairly good idea. Now it's beginning to sound a lot better. Now the 450 Yagi hanging on one end and the 2-meter Yagi hanging on the other end is a top hat capacitor, making that HF antenna electronically longer, mechanically shorter. In other words, if you were doing it on 80 meters because of the top hat capacitor of the Yagi, because of the top hat capacitor effect of the Yagi hanging on the end of the coax cable on each end, an 80 meter antenna wouldn't be 132 feet long. Maybe it's going to be a 98 feet long, if you know what I mean, when it hits resonance. But the RF doesn't give a darn, as long as it hits resonance. And if you've got an antenna tuner, you can even accommodate that. So, yes, he can make that fly. Thank goodness Joe gave us that hint. There's lots of ways to skin the cat. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Make sure that he writes back to us how well this works, John. You got it, John.
Yes, in fact, I had to write to him to have him send me a rough sketch because the way he worded it, I didn't understand what the hell he was talking about. But I personally think it would be a lot easier just to run another set of wires from pole to pole than to go through the ballon and the whole thing, and it would be an independent antenna, and he could do what you were saying before if he wanted to. But yeah, I think it's doable, but is it going to bring him what he wants? And I think the queue is going to be kind of tight, and he's going to have to make changes for each band. And you may be able to squeeze two bands out of it with a good tuner, but it's an interesting experiment. But both of these questions that came in tonight were really, really great. I enjoyed those. Okay, that's about it from Mel's Corner, and I hope he was listening because this is the kind of stuff he would do. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
N2XJN.
Yeah, the various doodads that are hanging on the poles, trees, and towers that were in Mel's backyard, K2KEY, used all of these kinds of techniques. And beautiful. Let's see if Paul's available before we go on to the deeper stuff. Paul, WS2N, I think there was another delay of that launch. And I think I'm reading in QST Magazine, yeah, I think it's the latest issue of QST Magazine, saying that the launch that's going to take place from Russia tomorrow of three more astronauts means that a total of six astronauts on the International Space Station will all have ham radio licenses. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, this is WS1. Yeah, that's happened before where everybody that's up there is a ham. It's happened with the shuttle flights. They all tend to get their ham license in Houston, and of course the Russians do it as well. Yeah, the Falcon Dragon launch is pushed back to May 19th. You'd have to get up early in the morning, so you're better off setting a recorder. 4:55, so I'll call it 5 a.m. in the morning. And that's the next possible time. Because of that Russian launch, with two Russians and one American on board, they don't launch simultaneously. They don't like to have two spacecraft going up to dock with the space station at the same time. They never did. If the Russians were sending somebody up or sending somebody down and the shuttle had to go up, the shuttle would be delayed until that was complete. So that's what they're going to do. They drop it. Sorry, I launched you. That's tomorrow and that'll dock. You know, it takes a couple of days. So that'll dock on the 17th of May. And then they'll bring the crew back up to six. It was six, and three came back a couple weeks ago. And it was just supposed to be three on board when the docking of this first commercial flight by SpaceX was going to happen. But now they're going to have six witnesses up there. And it should be pretty good. You know, they become active for this. It's not an automated system. It's not autonomous. It's like the Russian Progress and the ATV. It's going to come up close to the space station. The astronauts on board the space station will reach out with Canada Arm 2, grab a hold of it, and birth it in the Harmony node. Two nodes with Unity, and then there's Harmony. So Harmony is the last of the ones that went up there. And drop it. So it looks good for the 19th. They keep delaying it because of software on board Dragon. They want to make sure that it's right. It has to do with, you know, when you get in close to the space station, if something goes wrong, the software has to be able to know something is wrong and go into an abort mode, and they have to get that right. They're not going to be happy. NASA's not going to be happy until they correct it. So that's why so many delays on that. So, should be good. It'll go up there on the 19th, which is Saturday, and it'll get to the ISS on the 21st, and then they'll hang out and they'll go around the space station and check all the equipment on board before they get in close, and then it's all checked out, they're coming close, and then they'll dock on the 22nd, and then they'll stay up there for about 20 days, a little less than that, and then it'll return. Let me drop it. That's the one. It'll return in one piece, come down on a parachute, land in the Pacific, and then picked up by a commercial boat. With supplies on board that the crew will put on board. That's the good thing about Dragon. I know I've repeated this many times, but in case anybody hasn't heard it, that's what it will do. It's the only cargo vehicle out of the ones that go up there. The European Space Agency has the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle. Japan has the H2, and the Russians have the Progress. These are all cargo launches to supply the ISS, but they all come back as really garbage scows. They load it up with junk and it burns up over the Pacific, and that's it. You can't bring any scientific equipment, you know, experiments and things back. This thing can. We'll see how that goes. I just want to mention also, Curiosity is on course for landing August 5th. I know I've mentioned that before too. So that's on its way. A couple of months from now, we'll be talking a lot about Curiosity. They're running tests on land with the identical Curiosity that they have on, they have here. They're running tests, getting ready for a landing. Back to you to WS Glenn.
In the case of Curiosity, I believe there's only one spacecraft, not two. It's not going to be a bunch of beach balls that bounce onto the Martian surface. This thing, if I understand correctly, is going to be a parachute. Well, first of all, it's a heat shield that does some of the deceleration, then a parachute that does some of the deceleration, then a drop-down rope, as I remember, and then the rope gets cut and rockets fire at just the right time for it to do a rocket-assisted landing. By my standards, that's an extremely elaborate landing technique. It's a very big, heavy piece of hardware, something about the size of a Volkswagen. The Mars Lab, I'm going to call it, the Mars Science Lab. And so I guarantee there's going to be a lot of people in Pasadena. Let me drop. In Pasadena, California, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who are in charge of that project, who are going to be biting their nails when at the, let me pick a number, 100 million miles away. It's going to be approximately the distance between the Earth and the Mars at that particular period of time. Maybe it's 200 million miles away, but a long distance away. You know, a fraction of an hour for the signal to go from one to the other. If you see something going wrong and you send a signal saying, oh no, don't go there, do this instead, by the time the signal you send gets there, by the time the signal letting you know that something's wrong gets to you and then you respond and send it back, it's game over. The event, it's old news, if you know what I mean. So all they can do is be completely passive and watching what happens, make sure that all that computer program does the right thing. Hopefully enough individual transmitters get turned on, enough signals get picked up so that you know each step of the way. By studying the telemetry data in the downlink, you'll know each one of the steps, how well they worked. In case the whole thing crashes and you never get a signal from it again, at least you'll know something about it. So I guess you're saying further studies are taking place. They still got some time, as they did in the case of Spirit and Opportunity. They did make major changes to the computer program in flight on the way to Mars within hours of atmospheric encounter. They made major changes to the uplink computer program as to what it's going to do. I wonder if another one of those things is coming along. So this is going to be, from your and my point of view, Paul, a rather risky landing. There's only 40 things that can go wrong. Let's hope it all goes right. Bet you got some opinions on this. There's going to be some nail biting in Pasadena. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, I thought they were really nuts with Pathfinder when they first did that. Pathfinder and Sojourner, a little robot about the size of a microwave oven that rolled around on Mars for a while. That came down with the airbag. It worked out okay. Then the Spirit and Opportunity, they did the same thing. And now they're getting a little bit bigger. They're about the size of a golf cart. So now it's too big. Now they don't have the room to put all this stuff in the capsule for takeoff. You know, a certain diameter. That's all they get. Roughly 15 feet or so. A little bit bigger. And they're maxed out. The crew stage and takes up your space. This gigantic thing had no room for an airbag system, so they came up with this sky crane idea. And you're pretty much right toward the end a little bit there. They're on a cruise stage. Now they've got to separate from that first. And that thing has got solar panels and everything on it. They're actually doing tests and with all the 10 pieces of science, testing equipment aboard Curiosity now. They drop it. Checking all the different test equipment. They've got different spectrometers, alpha detectors, and all these weird things on board that to actually do the science that running tests, making sure everything's working. Well, that cruise stage has to separate first when they get near the planet. And that goes off into orbit around the sun. What's called the capsule part comes in, like you said, with the heat shield, slow it down to 13,000 mile run. If you were coming into Earth from that, you know, from outer space, not from orbit, from the moon or something, you'd come in at 25,000 miles per hour. So it's still, you know, pretty fast for Mars, 13,000, needs a heat shield. Then eventually the heat shield separates. You've got a parachute that comes out, slow everything down. Drogue chute comes out, and then this big gigantic one parachute comes out to slow it down and drop it. And like 1,300 miles per hour at this point. Then what happens is the parachute eventually disconnects, and you have the whole assembly falling, what they call the sky crane, and you've got the Curiosity mounted under it, under the sky frame. The eight rockets, I think they're eight rockets, fire. They're like mounted like on a 45, so the rocket blasts and going straight down to affect the equipment aboard Curiosity. So it's going on an angle, and they're being pulsed, you know, on and off like, you know, multiple times a second. Equipment is adjusting, you know, it knows, you know, what level is, so it comes down with these rockets firing, depending on, you know, this angle has to come up a little bit more, that part has to change the angle, so the rocket's got to fire all right. That part, to me, is amazing. Get near the ground, let me drop it. Curiosity drops out of the sky crane. Here these rockets are firing, and here's this thing dropping from it. And as it nears the ground, there's no rockets on board Curiosity. The second the rover touches the ground, the wheels are down right here, straight down. There's no ramps or anything like they had with Spirit and Opportunity and the Pathfinder, the Sojourner. Touches the ground, and then the sensors on board fire these pyrotechnic devices, little guillotine type of thing, cutting the drop cable, cutting the data cable, and the thing, you know, you've got to remember the rockets are still firing. Now this thing takes off and flies about a mile or two away from Curiosity, crash lands on the planet, and it's ready to go. That's it. So, not solar powered. It's got a nuclear device on board to keep it going. That's an amazing engineering feat.
It first encounters the Mars atmosphere at something like 13,000 miles an hour, is what I think you said. I'd like to believe there's a heat shield used at first before it first deploys the drogue chute. Is that true? That's question number one, Paul. And what day in August does this encounter take place? It sure would be nice if it took place at 8 o'clock at night, New York City time, any day of the week, so that we could watch it on television. So what day, what hour do you think is the encounter? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, right now it's August 5th, UTC time. Day. So I had early in the morning UTC time. So probably, you know, let's call it 7 o'clock in the morning over in England, with a 5-hour difference, so it's going to be earlier here. They don't give the time. If it's, say, let's say 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, it might be, you know, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night here on a previous day. But right now, early morning on this August 5th UTC. the drogue chute, yeah, they, well, yeah, the heat shield slows it down first.